Good evening, everybody. Great to see Sydney in such great form. I was asked to speak tonight, as Sydney said, about the future of the MRC over the next 25 or even 100 years. Now, I make no claims to being a futurologist. If I could predict the future, I would have probably given up science years ago and taken up betting on the horses. But I will try my best with this impossible task. But before starting on my thoughts for the future, though, I want to affirm that the MRC is one of Britain's crown jewels, an important part of Britain's intellectual infrastructure, one of our national treasures. I can say this really objectively, as I was turned down by the MRC, Laboratory of Molecular Biology, when I applied there for a job many years ago. In fact, I think Sydney might have even been the director at the time. Now, let me begin by asking, will there still be a need for the MRC over the next 100 years? And the answer to this question is clearly yes. Disease remains a major scourge for humankind and will continue to be so in the coming century. And it's science that gives us the means to eradicate and to control disease. And the opportunities that science will provide over these coming decades to achieve these objectives will be many. 100 years ago, when the MRC was founded in 1913, biomedical science was in its infancy. For example, genetics and biochemistry were barely invented, and there was no conception of molecular biology, structural biology, or genomics, all of which today contribute greatly to our understanding of biomedicine. Yet, despite these limited beginnings, the advances of the last century have resulted in extraordinary improvements in lifespan and in healthcare. So just imagine what is likely to be achieved in the next 100 years, given our present knowledge and the potential that we now have to dramatically improve that knowledge. It's also important to recognise that this applies not only to improving human health, but also to providing opportunities in the UK for the creation of wealth. Now, one of the reasons the MRC has been so successful is that it has always recognised the importance of what I call discovery science. That is, that better understanding of how living organisms work is fundamental to controlling disease, to improving human health. Now, in this talk, I'm going to focus on science and give my view of some of the scientific problems where significant progress, in my view at least, can be expected over the coming decades. Where appropriate, I'll comment on their relevance for tackling human disease. One major research objective will be the cell. The cell is the basic unit of life. And as the 19th century founder of pathology, Rudolf Virchow, argued, it is the pathological behaviours of cells that form the basis of many diseases. There are now real opportunities to advance our knowledge of how cells work, using a combination of techniques and approaches, including advanced microscopic visualization of living cells, biochemistry and genetics. And because the cell is the simplest entity exhibiting the characteristics of life, many of the principles underlying how life works are likely to be found through the study of the cell. A primary objective will be to combine the descriptions of molecular phenomena underlying cellular behavior into a complete description of the cell and its operations. This requires an approach whereby the cell is considered as a complex system made up of molecular components that generate higher level biological functions and behaviours. However, it's important that we are not satisfied solely with the descriptions of molecular phenomena. Our real objective is to build on these descriptions to establish improved understanding, not description, but understanding. Now, what will be essential in this approach was an approach that was dominant during the early years of molecular biology, one emphasised at the time by Sydney. That is the importance of information and the management of information. This means understanding how information is gathered, stored and used to generate purposeful teleonomic outcomes. The lessons learnt about information management in living systems obtained from cells will apply across tissues, organs, and organisms as well. In my view, this approach, perhaps contentiously, will also be informed by applying concepts developed by evolutionary and ecological scientists who have long been studying complex living systems. Now, one major problem with this systems approach is knowing what values of molecular parameters should be fed into the subsequent analyses. For example, present approaches generally try to estimate the rate constants and concentrations that operate within the cell, but these are difficult to accurately determine for all the parameters necessary. A possible solution will be to reduce the complexity of descriptions to black boxes, focusing on inputs and outputs that can be measured, rather than trying to describe all the details of what goes on within those boxes. Understanding cells requires a work in a range of organisms, including single-celled organisms such as bacteria and yeasts, because the problems will be easier to solve with those simpler organisms. But ultimately, we need to understand human cells if we were to work out the basis of human disease. A good example is cancer. Cancer occurs as a consequence of genetic damage in cells, which leads to uncontrolled cell division and to cell shape and motility changes that result in the spread of cells throughout the body. These disease pathologies can be best understood and better managed through improved knowledge of how human cells work. The poet Alexander Pope is sometimes misunderstood when his line, "The proper study of mankind is man," is quoted in support of the importance of researching human beings rather than the rest of the living kingdom. In fact, Pope was attempting to redirect human endeavour away from God, as is clear in his preceding line to that poem, "Know then thyself, presume not God to scam." Nevertheless, it is right to focus on biomedical research on the study of humans, as we've just heard Sydney argue. In coming decades, there will be a continuing need for the study of model living organisms, including mice, but increasingly, we need to take all opportunities possible to investigate human beings. I'm not speaking here only of translational work, that is, research aimed at achieving a particular diagnostic or therapeutic outcome, but of research into human biology. There are a number of promising possibilities for human biology. First is genomics. That is, exploiting knowledge of the sequence of the genome and its variation within human populations. There have been criticisms of those who advocated the sequencing of the human genome for promising too much too quickly. Those criticisms are unfair. Although there were some who overpromised the rapidity of applications, knowledge of the human genome sequence is critical for future advances. The metaphor I use is that the human genome sequence is like having the list of the characters in a play. It is essential for the play to be written, but it is not sufficient. The task now is to use that cast list, that is the sequence, to help write the text of the play, that is to understand how humans work. Using the genome variations within populations and correlating them with phenotypic variations, including predisposition to disease, helps inform the genetic contribution to disease. Sometimes this will be relatively simple. More often, it will be complex, sometimes very complex, as many genetic differences are likely to contribute to disease onset. But as more data is gathered together over the coming decades, then these complexities will be gradually unravelled. What will be especially powerful is to combine this deep knowledge of genetics with investigation of the effects of the environment, including variations in an individual's microbiome, that is, the microbes that work, that live on or within a human being, and the effects of all of that on human health and human disease. This is essentially a rerun of the nature-nurture debate, but it should not be seen as a conflict because it is so obvious that both are important. Rather, they should be combined in major epidemiological studies to improve our power of prediction beyond what is possible if only genetic or environmental differences are examined. This is a big data issue, which the UK is well poised to tackle with its strength in genomics and with the National Health Service, a unitary healthcare delivery system that, if effectively used, has great potential for this type of research. Because the NHS is seen to be a service for the people rather than as a profit-based system, I believe many of the public will be happy to contribute their own personal data for ultimate public good. This approach will eventually contribute to a more precise, personalised medicine tailoring treatment to the individual, based, however, not only on genome sequences, but on other physiological and pathological markers as well. Genome sequencing will also be illuminating about the pathways implicated in disease predisposition, opening up new approaches to diagnosis and to therapy. Because the cost of sequencing is dropping, it is not far-fetched to expect that soon everyone at birth will have their genome sequenced, although that carries with it certain ethical implications that also have to be considered. A second opportunity in human biology is to promote new approaches to human physiology using sophisticated imaging modalities. Imaging used in clinical care can also be employed for studies of human physiology. It needs to be combined with chemistry and radiochemistry to provide new markers that can monitor physiological states throughout the body. A more fanciful development might be to generate miniature micro-robots that can travel freely around the body, which are equipped with micro-sensors to detect their local environments. Perhaps they could also be equipped with microscopic worms that burrow into solid tissue to monitor more remote regions of the body in a relatively non-invasive manner. All of this before I've had wine, by the way. Given that these micro-robots will be controlled from outside the body, they might be further developed for use in microsurgery. Multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary approaches will clearly be required for such initiatives. A third opportunity will be to use human stem cells combined with 3D tissue scaffolds to create prototypic human organs on the bench. Not just for organ replacement, as is often proposed, but also for physiological studies. Studies of such benchtop human organs would complement human models, helping to better understand normal human physiology, as well as providing possibilities for treatment of degenerative disease. Genetic manipulation of the cells used to generate these organs would allow disease states to be more readily modeled, as well as allowing sensing systems to be built into cells to more precisely monitor cellular and tissue behaviours. These types of human studies will provide novel approaches to many major diseases. Understanding the brain is difficult. In fact, understanding the brain is very difficult. I think two contrasting approaches will be important in the coming decades. The first, given the complexity of the problem, is the use of simpler model systems to study the nervous system, brains and behaviour, particularly invertebrate models, such as the worm, pioneered by Sydney here, and the fly. The simple organisms can be studied whilst they perform behavioural acts in virtual environments, monitoring their brains and nervous systems in real time, correlating neuron activity at a fine level with sensory inputs and behavioural outputs. Another opportunity is to study of neural development using, for example, transparent zebrafish embryos. Working on these simpler systems should help develop the more general principles that can underpin neuroscience and its application to mammalian cell systems, including human beings. The second approach is to try and combine neuroscience studies of the human brain with studies of the mind. There is real promise here too, but it is difficult and requires overcoming the often cultural barriers that exist between the often quite different scientists who work on the one hand on neuroscience and on the other hand on the mind. Just look at the popular press, how they row all the time. Infectious disease continues to be a major problem, both in the developing world but here also in the UK. New ways of combating infectious agents are required, especially to deal with antibiotic resistance in bacteria. One promising approach, I think, will be the use of what's called environmental, or eDNA. Only a rather small fraction of microorganisms can be cultured easily in the laboratory, but their DNA can be extracted from natural sources, such as soil, and can then be cloned and expressed in cultivatable microorganisms. These can then be subsequently screened in the laboratory for example, antibiotic activity or new biochemical activities. The use of eDNA should, I think, significantly widen the classes of antibiotics that will be made available. Well, these are my thoughts about some of the science that the MRC might be taking on in the coming decades. But I want to end to consider how the MRC should operate in the future to be effective. It is an organisation which is Janus-like, looking one way towards the clinic and the other way towards the more basic and biological and physical sciences. A standalone research council is best placed to achieve these dual relationships. As is the case now, and has been generally in the past, the MRC needs to be led by a distinguished biomedical scientist, someone who will provide scientific leadership and not just managerial competence. The MRC needs to put emphasis on the quality of individual scientists that it supports and ensure that it continues to employ a broad-based approach, covering discovery research for long-term progress, translational research for the medium term, and clinical research and trials for short-term improvements in the management of disease. Is there anything new the MRC should think about doing organisationally? I think it should consider using more public-private partnerships in clinical trials, working better both with the NHS and with industry. The span of investigation in a clinical trial could be expanded beyond the focus objective of a commercial company, which generally has a specific translational application in mind, to include monitoring many more markers of human physiology. This information can then be used to determine if the drugs or other interventions being tested may be relevant to other physiological systems or disease states beyond the focused interest of the company. This is a cultural change which emphasises major clinical trials not simply as a proof of principle, but as a research tool, a change that will require new practice, some new money, and a clear shift in regulatory frameworks. I end where I began, emphasising how important the MRC is as a valuable part of our intellectual infrastructure. Without question, it will continue to make important scientific discoveries that will lead to great improvements in the human condition over the next century. But we need to recognise that the MRC and biomedical research in the UK face great competition from the rest of the world. This comes not only from scientifically developed nations such as the USA and Germany, who spend significantly more on science than we do in the United Kingdom, but also from nations such as China and India, who are rapidly increasing their budgets and improving the quality of their research. This is something our political leaders need to take account of, not only, however, over the next century, but right now, today, in the next spending review. Thank you very much.